think I'm on up here. All right. Is that good? Okay. Good morning. We're winding down pretty quick. Today, we're going to be looking at the last three chapters of the book of Judges. But as Freddie indicated Wednesday night, these stories do not necessarily fall at the end of the Judges or even toward the end. Rather, maybe even before the Judges started. He talked about the migration of the tribe of Dan Wednesday night and referred back to Joshua chapter 19. If you look in 19 verse 51, I believe it is, you will see at that particular time Eliezer was the high priest. Now, if you look toward the end of the book of Judges, chapter 22, whenever the 2.5 tribes had gone back to the east side of Jordan, we find out at that point, Phinehas was the high priest, the son of Eliezer. And today, if you look at chapter 21 of the book of Judges, you will notice that Phinehas is the high priest. So, somewhere toward the end of Joshua's life, or even maybe prior to the beginning of the Judges, is probably about the time the story we're going to look at today occurred. But the last verse in the book of Judges is the same verse that Freddie read earlier, which gives an indication of maybe how things were going in general. We won't say everybody, but it said, every man did what was right in his own eyes. So possibly we see this attitude maybe being reflected in the story that we see today. We'll be looking walk this thing up a little bit. The general area that we're going to be talking about centers around kind of the center of the area. That's Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Gibeah, Ramah, Shiloh, some of the towns that we'll be talking about today in the tribe of Ephraim. This is not a pleasant story. In fact, it's a sad story. A lot of things that we see in this lesson today are very difficult for us to understand. But that's the way it was in that particular time, but I think we can learn some things from it. We talk about a concubine. She did not have the same rights as a regular wife. Neither did her children have the same inheritance as the children of a regular wife. If you look back over in Genesis, when Hagar was sent away, these words were issued. Genesis chapter 21. He shall not be heir with my son. And then if you look at Genesis 25, verses 5 and 6, when Abraham was about to die, verse 25 said, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. Verse 6 said, only he gave gifts to his sons of his concubines and sent them to the east. So, maybe a concubine might have always been a handmaid or maybe a lower class person, but that does not change some of the things that happen in this story. But today we find a man, a Levite, who lived up in the hill country of of Ephraim. Said he lived on the side of Mount Ephraim, generally located where the tabernacle was at. In fact, if you look at chapter 19, verse 18, when he's questioned as to where he'd been and where he was going, he said he was going home to the house of the Lord. So he lived at least in the general vicinity of the tabernacle. But we find that this concubine that he had was unfaithful. And she runs away to her father's house down in Bethlehem, and she stays there for about 4 months. But the Levite decides he will go and visit her, and notice the words, and be kind to her. And when he gets there, she actually invites him in to her father's house. He's there for a few days. It seemed like the father, whether they had ever met before or not, we don't know. But he seemed to be happy to see the Levite. In fact, over and over, as the Levite would prepare to leave the next day, he would convince him to stay. But on the fifth day, he finally says, I'm out of here. His father-in-law is still trying to get him to stay another night, leave the next morning early, but he departs late in the day, basically over his father-in-law's objection. But they're traveling back to the north, leaving Bethlehem, heading back toward Jerusalem, Gibeah, Ramah, on up toward Shiloh, their final destination. But as they get to near Jerusalem, the servant suggests that they stay there in the city of Jerusalem, the city of the Jebusites. We ran across those people before, and they will be there for a long time. But the Levite, he's not too happy about spending the night in a city that's not one of the belonging to the children of Israel. So he suggests that we press on to the north. We can make it to Gibeah, possibly up to Ramah. But as they approach Gibeah, the sun is about to go down, and so he makes preparations to stay there. Nobody invites him into the house, so he just sets up camp out in the street. But he doesn't seem to mind at all with what's going on. And we'll see that as we look at the rest of the story. But about nightfall, or after sunset, there's an old man who originally was from Ephraim, but he's now living in Gibeah. He's been out in the field working, and he comes by and sees these three people out in the street, the Levite, the concubine, and the Levite's servant, along with a couple of donkeys. So he invites them into the house. But the Levite, he said, well, okay. You know, I've got food for the straw. I've got straw for the donkeys. I've got bread and wine for me and the concubine and the servant. So, we're okay. But the man from Ephraim, he's not too happy with that. In fact, he has already asked him. He said, where are you from? Where you been? Where are you going? He said, I've been to Bethlehem. He doesn't tell him why. He just says, I've been to Bethlehem, and I'm on the way back home up to the house of the Lord. So the man says, no, you're not going to spend the night out in the street. Come inside, and I will take care of you. You will be my guest. And so that was the plan. So there we are. We're in this location, we're in Gibeah, as this story continues to unfold. But they're there. The old man has fed the donkeys. He's fed his guests. He's washed their feet, as the custom of the day was. And they just seem to be having a rather enjoyable time as the night goes along. But that's going to change rather quickly. The wicked men of the city surround the house and begin to beat on the door and make the same request that the men of Sodom had made of Lot hundreds of years prior to this particular time. This is something that we have a hard time comprehending. But the old man offers his daughter and also the concubine to the men rather than allowing this guest of his to go out and be molested by these men. But the men of the city refuse. And so now the Levite speaks up. And he offered his concubine, and they took her out and abused her until morning. Now, it seems to be that the sin of sodomy may have even been considered worse by these men than what by offering the daughter and so forth. So look at verse 23 of that particular chapter 19, Judges 19, verse 23. It said, the last phrase in that, do not this folly. Don't do this. Don't use this man. Verse 24. But unto this man do not so vile a thing. So he refers to it as folly, something very vile, sodomy. However, that does not justify their actions. Now, I guess we can learn something here. Custom never takes precedence over God's law. And there is no distinction. I don't find any distinction in the Bible between sin. Sin is sin. White is white. Black is black. There's no gray. And I think we need to understand that. And I believe we can understand that from this particular thing. But we find this young lady being mistreated all night. And she is finally released by these men. And she makes her way back to the house. And as she gets there, she falls on her hands at the threshold of the door and lays there until daylight. Well, morning comes. The Levite, he gets up, prepares to go on his way, probably thinking he'll never see this concubine again. But there she lays on the threshold of the door. Again, probably thinking she's asleep. He said, get up. No response. The woman is dead. And what he does now seems very odd to us. He takes her body, places it on the donkey, carries her home to his house, takes his knife, and cuts her into 12 pieces, and sends those 12 pieces to every tribe throughout Israel. Now, you may wonder, what's he doing? Well, there's a similar situation that happens later on in 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 7. When Nahash came and was going to destroy the city of Jabesh-Gilead, Saul, who has kind of been hiding, he's now a king, but he's kind of been laying low, so to speak. But he kind of gets riled up about this, and he takes the yoke of oxen, and he cuts them in pieces, and he sends them out throughout the land of Israel, more or less saying, hey guys, we got some stuff we need to deal with. And so the whole Israelite nation comes together. And so we see the same type thing happening here. As these pieces of this woman's body went throughout the land, we see people saying, no such thing has been done in Israel since Egypt. They're saying, in effect, we need to go and deal with these people who have abused this woman. And we see that happening. 400,000 of the men of Israel gathered together at Mizpah, which is just north of where we're talking. And they don't make any bones about we're gathering together, because they said Benjamin, the people of Benjamin, they knew that this huge army had been gathered together. But they didn't seem too concerned about it. But as these people came together, they came to the Levite and they asked, you know, what's happened here? In verse 3, they said, tell us how was this wickedness? You know, tell us how all this happened. And so he explains it in chapter 20 and verse 4, 5, and 6. And the Levite, the husband of the woman that was slain, answered and said, I came into Gibeah that belonged to Benjamin. I and my concubine to lodge. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and beset the house round about upon by night and thought to have slain me. And my concubine have they forced that she is dead. And I took my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel. For they have committed lewdness and folly in Israel. So now he says, in verse 7, behold, ye are all children of Israel. Give here advice and your counsel. So what are we going to do about it? That's what he's saying. And all the people rose up and they decided, we're going to go out against Benjamin. Nobody's going to go back to the tent or his house until this thing is settled. And verse 11 indicates there was no dissension. So they were all knit together as one man. But before they do that, they actually use a little bit of restraint, so to speak. And they go out throughout the inheritance of Benjamin, asking, what wickedness is this that is among you? That's verse 12. So you need to give us these wicked guys so we can put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But Benjamin does not respond favorably to that request. In fact, they gather their army and get ready to go to battle with the other people of Israel. Well, you think that's really not all that smart. Here they've got 26,000 plus a few hundred skilled men. And these were skilled men, by the way. It said they were left-handed and they could sling stones and hit a hair's breadth and not miss. So I guess they felt pretty confident. 26,000 plus all these real skilled people, we're not going to worry about these 400,000 people. And right away, it seems like they may have been okay. Because as Israel, they go to the house of the Lord, and in Bob's book, he refers to it as Bethel. I don't know whether I would say that's probably Shiloh. So when you see on these slides Bethel, I think you need to insert the word Shiloh. But before the Israelites go out, they do go and they ask God, who we ought to send first. Very similar to what happened when they were fixing to drive out the inhabitants of the land. God said, Judah, you go first. Well, things didn't go well. 22,000 of the Israelites were killed on the first day. Well, they go back and ask God again about it. He says, go again. The second day, it doesn't say exactly who went. It just talks about Israel. But 18,000 are killed the second day. I think I would have been like some of them. I think I would have been wondering, is this really a good idea? These 26,000 plus 700, they're pretty well taking care of whoever comes out. But they go back to Shiloh. They weep. They fast. They offer sacrifices, both burnt offerings and peace offerings. And here's where we see Phinehas, what I referred to earlier. He's the priest at this time. And he stands before the Ark of the Covenant and asks God again, should we go out? And so this time God says, yes, you go out again. But this time things are going to be different. I'm going to deliver Benjamin into your hands. So as the people go out this time, they've got a little bit different strategy. They send a few over to lie in wait, and then the rest of the army, they attack the men of Benjamin. And it looks like from Benjamin's side, things are going to go good just like they have before. In fact, they kill about 30 of them. Right quick. So they're feeling pretty good. But all of a sudden, they turn around and look back at the city, and it's on fire. The guys who have been lying in wait are now burning the city, and they come out, and here they find themselves, the men of Benjamin, in between the two forces. And 25,100 of the men of Benjamin died that day as these two forces joined together. And only 600 of them escaped, and they went to a place called Rock of Remian. And I don't know where that's at, but it has to be close by. They said they stayed there for 4 months. We'll see in a minute that at the end of that 4 months, the men of Israel actually go and promise these guys, you can come out peaceably, as the story unfolds. But not only did they kill 25,000 of these people that were in the war, they went ahead and just ravaged the whole countryside of Benjamin, killing the rest of the men in every city, and burning every city. Now, if you look at chapter 21 and verse 16, it's clear indication that they killed everybody, including the women, because in the last part of verse 16 of chapter 21, it says, seeing the women are destroyed out of Benjamin. So, I mean, they just wiped out the countryside, so to speak. Well, this is as a result trying to get revenge for what had happened the two previous days. We don't know. But whatever the situation was, things kind of got out of hand. And all of a sudden, these people realize we have, did I go one too many? Yeah. These people realize we basically wiped out one tribe of our nation. And so I guess we can learn a lesson here too. Don't lose your cool and go out in a fit of anger and do something or say something stupid. I don't know any other way to say it, but I think that's what we ought to learn. These people lost their control, almost wiped out the entire nation of Benjamin. Now, we got a problem. Not only have we killed all the women and most of the men, but we've made an oath when we came together in Mizpah that nobody from our tribes are going to give their daughters to anybody from Benjamin for a wife. So what do we do? Well, what do? We cry to Jehovah. We offer sacrifices because we're about to lose a tribe. You see anything in the text that says God said, okay, let me tell you what to do? No. There's no indication that God responded to their cry or to their sacrifice. Not only that, they said, let's see now. How are we going to get out of this? We made an oath. We can't break that. But we got to save this tribe somehow or another. They said, let's think about this. Well, let's say we also made an oath, too, that everybody's going to come together and fight against Benjamin, and we're going to make this thing right. Let's see if anybody decided not to come. So they number the people. Nobody from Jabesh-Gilead was in the number. So they said, okay, this is what we'll do. We'll just get 12,000 of our valiant men. In fact, the valiants of our men. And we're going to go down to Jabesh-Gilead, and we're going to fight against them. And we're going to have our 12,000 men kill all the men and all the married women in Jabesh-Gilead. And whoever those virgins are that are still alive, we're going to bring them home. And we're going to give them to the men of Benjamin. Problem was there was only 400 of them. And we got 600 men. So what are we going to do now? So the plan continues to create problems. So they said, now, there's a feast up at Shiloh every year. It's an annual feast. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to have the men, those other 200 guys that still don't have a wife, we're going to let them hide in the vineyard. And when one of these young ladies come out from the dance and so forth and kind of get separated from the crowd, you just go up and grab her. And you hightail it back to Benjamin. That's what they did. And saved the tribe of Benjamin. Now look at what these guys said. The last few verses, let's see, verse 22. And they said, and it shall be when their fathers or their brethren come unto us to complain that we're going to say to them, well, be favorable unto them for our sakes, because we reserve not in each man his wife in the war, For we did not give unto them at this time that ye should be given. So we've got this thing solved. We made an oath that we wouldn't give them any wives out of our tribe. And so when 200 of our daughters disappear, we're going to say, well, we didn't give them to you. We didn't give them to them. So we didn't break our oath. Do we sometimes scheme quotation marks to get around our commitment to God and maybe our commitment to our fellow man? You don't have to hold up your hand with me. Think about that. These people, again, God did not respond when they ask him, what do we do? But this is how they handled it. And again, I think it goes back to the statement we read earlier, verse 25 of chapter 21 of the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Even possibly toward the end of Joshua's life or very soon thereafter, we see the nation of Israel in pretty bad shape. And so there's no reason or no reason why we should be surprised that over a period of time, as these people repented, God would send a judge to deliver them. And then pretty soon they would go further into sin. God, after they repented, he would send another judge. And so the cycle just continued for some 300 to 350 years. So it's a very sad time. But after the United Kingdom, which I guess Wayne, you'll be teaching next quarter, you'll see things maybe kind of jail, but toward the end of Solomon's life, we see him getting involved in everything imaginable against God's command. And as a result, as his son takes over, the kingdom is divided. And from then on, it's just a downhill slide. So, all right. Let's see. I had one more, but there's Shiloh again, where these people, they would catch these women and take off back down to Benjamin with their new wives. Questions, comments? Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Their words didn't make any difference, but we see the same effect earlier in chapter 21 or chapter 20. When the Levite was retelling the story, he wasn't totally honest then either. He gave the impression, and he said, this is verse 6 of chapter 20, I took hold of my concubine and cut her into pieces and sent her throughout the country.
Yeah.
Verse 5. The men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house of night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravaged my house.
Yeah.
Well, he left out the fact that he
offered her. That's right.
Now,
yeah.
To me, back in chapter 19, the text is not clear. When it says in verse 25, so the man seized his concubine. Was it the Levite seizing his own concubine, or was it the old man seized his concubine? Well, if it was the Levite that gave his own concubine, then that's wicked.
Yeah.
If it was the old man, he didn't have a concubine and prevent him from offering. So either way, he was guilty. So in both cases, this is human behavior. We try to excuse ourselves by trickery of speech when we're guilty of something that's vile and wicked. And however we want to retell it or rephrase it, does it change our guilt? And I think that's the lesson.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, Jeff goes back to chapter 19 and also chapter 20. When the people wanted to have him come out, then, you know, he offers a concubine or the old man. That's not right to do that. And then when the Levite retold the story, he just kind of left out a few minor details, you know. Yeah, minor details, you know. So sometimes we tell those half-truths, don't we, Jeff, to kind of defend what we have done. So we see this idea of scheming that we talked about pretty well infiltrates the whole story that we dealt with today. All right, good point, Jeff. Yeah, about 65,000 people. 40,000 out of Israel the first 2 days, and 25 or so thousand out of Benjamin. No, I don't think God's happy with what is taking place. No. Again, custom does not ever overrule God's law. And I think these people were reaping the consequences of all of this. Yeah, our society is down on the slippery slope. No question about it. Other comments? Got it? Now, Randall's point is that sometimes we say, well, it's just me. You know, I do what I want to do. But, as he pointed out, the actions toward just one person here, or the actions of the Levite and the old man allowing this thing to happen, it affected the whole nation of Israel. And as we talked about, 65,000 people died as a result of this situation. Yes. Yeah, Lauren points out that we usually go into court and they say, do you swear or do you affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help me God. We need to take that oath or affirmation serious. And we don't have to be in the court of law. Jesus said, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, and whatever you say needs to be the truth. The whole truth, nothing but the truth. All right. Appreciate your comments. And Wednesday night, Freddie will give a review over the book of Joshua, then, Lord willing, next Sunday, we'll have a review over the rest of what we covered and wrap up the quarter.